When the Anti-Defamation League, or ADL, was founded more than a century ago, the mission was to combat anti-Semitism. That has remained a constant and has been expanded to include any victims of bias and hate, injustice and discrimination, including bullying and violence in any of their forms. There are plenty of such victims today, from members of the Jewish community to people who are black or brown to Muslims and gays in America. Jonathan Greenblatt is the CEO and national director of the Anti-Defamation League. He will receive the Sister Mary Biles Peace and Justice Prize at a presentation and lecture at 7 p.m. today at Maryville University. Jonathan, welcome and congratulations.
Thank you, Don. I appreciate that.
I wish we had a full program today to talk about the things that we're going to be talking about, but what is the most urgent thing you have in your inbox these days?
Well, it's funny. I think the most urgent issue for the ADL today is the issue that animated the creation of the ADL over 100 years ago. It's the fight against anti-Semitism and bigotry in all forms and the effort to secure civil rights and social justice for all.
The recent incidents concerning the Jewish community centers and the desecration of cemeteries has certainly reignited that conversation, hasn't it?
I think that's right. I mean, I think what we saw, and it really kicked up during the presidential campaign, was anti-Semitism as well as other forms of bigotry moving from the margins to the mainstream. We saw it during the debates, and then we saw it in the general election season, where you had candidates who were, you know, finding ways to talk about not just Jewish people, but all kinds of people and differences in ways that most politicians just don't do. And since the election, we've seen an upsurge in hate crimes directed against the Jewish community. We've seen vandalism, harassment, assaults, cyber attacks, and of course these bomb threats, which recently were just resolved. But St. Louis has really been in the news as part of that.
It certainly has. How do you explain this? I mean, what is going on? You tie it to the election. How closely can you tie it to that campaign?
Well, I think what happened during the campaign was that the candidate, in particular Donald Trump, tapped into a great deal of frustration that exists just under the surface. I mean, let's be honest. People are concerned and they're scared. People see that the political establishment is not finding the answers to these vexing, difficult challenges, like how do we deal with automation? How do we, you know, handle globalization? Where will technology take us forward? And then what are the economic and educational and sort of social ramifications of these changes? And as we know throughout history, when faced with these sort of difficult systemic challenges, people often resort to prejudice as a way not to necessarily solve a problem, but to scapegoat a group of people. And that happened. And now, that isn't to say that our candidates were necessarily doing it, but by acquiescing to it, by failing to call it out, that allowed some of our, rather than our better angels being lifted up, some of our worst impulses were played to.
So it was an enabling process, really. It's something below the surface, which has probably been there forever. It came to the surface.
I believe that's correct. You know, I think we look to our elected, you know, officials. We look to sort of public figures for a kind of moral leadership. And for generations, when anti-Semitism would seep into the mainstream, whether it's a university president or the U.S. president, our leaders would stamp it out. They would shut it down. They would say, enough. And it didn't take people in the press or activists to cajole them and implore them to do that. That wasn't until last year. And so this environment is almost conducive to the extremists infiltrating and, you know, exploiting that vacuum.
Infiltrating, and in some cases infiltrating all the way to the White House, if we look at some of the personalities that have emerged and are present there.
I think it's safe to say that it's a bit inexplicable, some of these sort of personnel choices, in as much as they seem to be, again, rewarding the wrong impulses. I mean, we teach our children right from wrong. We teach our children not to bully, not to call people names, not to segregate their classmates or their peers based on how they look or where they're from or how they pray, which is why we find the pattern of behavior most recently so baffling.
Do you work at all, the Anti-Defamation League, work at all with the Southern Poverty Law Center?
Absolutely, we do.
Okay. I just want to read you something that I saw earlier today from one of their publications. 2016 was an unprecedented year for hate, said Mark Potok, senior fellow and editor of the Intelligence Report, which is published by that organization. Quote here, the country saw a resurgence of white nationalism that imperils the racial progress we've made, along with the rise of a president whose policies reflect the values of white nationalists. This is pretty serious stuff to be writing and to be saying today about our leadership.
Yes, I mean, look, to the question that's been posed to me, is Donald Trump an anti-Semite? Of course he's not an anti-Semite. He has Jewish grandchildren. His daughter converted. This is a man who's worked with Jews his entire life, which is why it's so paradoxical and so problematic that he's been unwilling to, with the same kind of firmness and forcefulness that he uses to call out, you know, television ratings or Broadway shows, he doesn't call out the bigots and the haters. And, you know, as examples of that, when David Duke endorsed him, we waited for him to rush to that moment and to use it to tear down the haters. Didn't happen at all. And, you know, more recently, when a Jewish Orthodox reporter in the East Room asked him a question, which, by the way, he prefaced with praise, Donald Trump, maybe he didn't hear it, maybe he didn't understand it, maybe he was distracted. I don't know what was the cause, but here was what we saw. The spectacle of the president of the United States shouting down a Jewish reporter in ways that white nationalists not only were waiting for or had hoped for, they rejoiced. And at the ADL, our Center on Extremism has been researching the extreme right and other extremist movements for generations. And indeed, Don, what we saw was the white nationalists celebrating in social media, praising the president in the press for, again, calling down that reporter.
There's plenty of reason for American Jews to be concerned about this, but also for Muslims in America, Hispanics in America. I mean, they're all in the firing line, as it were.
I think that's right. Historically, Jews have been the canary in the coal mine.
Yeah.
But again, the kind of rhetoric that we've seen in the past 18 months, denigrating Mexicans as coming across the border as being all rapists and murderers, suggesting that all Muslims need to be monitored as if they were all terrorists, suggesting that, you know, all African Americans today live shackled in poverty and in the worst conditions ever. I mean, these are, at best, these are gross mischaracterizations. At worst, there's something else going on. And I think what we know is what actually makes America great right now is our pluralism. It is our diversity. It is these things which make America a light unto the nations, and we should celebrate that.
It's what made America, period.
Correct.
Because that's the background of our country.
That's right.
So what can organizations like yours do?
Well, what we do is kind of, in some ways, what we've always done. You know, the ADL basically does advocacy, education, and works with law enforcement. So number one, we try to change laws through the courts and through Congress in order to make sure they, again, respect the civil rights and provide equal treatment to all. Number two, we have education programs. We're one of the largest providers in the United States of anti-bias, anti-bullying, anti-hate content for kids. We reach about 2 million school children a year. And then number three, we work with law enforcement to investigate hate crimes, to help research and understand these movements, but also to train them on how to deal with extremism and hate. So what we're doing in the face of this current situation is, number one, emphasizing our law enforcement training to make sure that police departments and law enforcement agencies understand how to deal with challenging issues. Number two, updating and spreading our anti-hate, anti-bullying content in classrooms. And then finally, number three, advocating to make sure that a new administration and a new Congress provides the same protections and respect for all people, again, no matter where they're from or how they look or who they love.
Lobbying in Congress.
Well, in Congress and also in state houses across the country, including here in Missouri. You know, the ADL has 27 offices across the United States, and our advocacy means we're working state houses and city councils as much as the halls of Congress, as well as work in the courts and filing amicus briefs, analyzing cases, again, trying to use the law to its fullest extent possible.
What kinds of laws are on the books? How specific are they?
Well, it depends on what issue we're talking about. You know, the ADL is the organization that literally wrote the laws on hate crimes years ago. Now we want to make sure that those hate crimes laws continue to be enforced. I had a meeting with Attorney General Sessions just last week in Washington, and I sat with him in his office and implored him to ensure that he not only enforces hate crimes laws, because they're on the books, as a senator, he didn't really support them, but they're the law of the land. Mm-hmm. And number two, to make sure that law enforcement agencies report on hate crimes. It's stunning, but over 80% of law enforcement agencies across the United States either don't report hate crimes or report zero every year. We know that's wrong.
Aren't they relatively difficult to identify and classify? I mean, certain very specific things have to be present in order
that's
for
right.
a hate crime to be called a hate crime.
That's right. Hate crimes are situations wherein someone is the basis of the basis of the crime, the basis of the incident is the inalienable characteristics of a person or a place. Mm-hmm. So defacing a synagogue with swastikas carries a different meaning than simply vandalizing somebody's home. Mm-hmm. Or assaulting a Muslim person coming out of a mosque has a different sort of meaning than just an ordinary mugging. And that's because hate crimes are intended not only to inflict pain on a particular victim, but also to spread terror amongst the community. That's why they're different.
So with your training with law enforcement,
mm-hmm.
how does that go? I mean, that individual policemen tell them how to identify a crime? Is
good,
that basically
good question. Well, yeah. We train about 15,000 officers a year, including all FBI recruits. In fact, the FBI's executive team. Many big cities send their recruits like the NYPD and the Philadelphia Police Department. So our trainings are about how to identify extremism, how to deal with hate crimes, how to help those who've been victimized, again, on the basis of an inalienable characteristic.
Mm-hmm. How does that go generally?
It goes pretty well. I mean, we have more demand than we can meet. Mm-hmm. So we have sort of waiting lists for our trainings. And I think the reason is because ADL has been known to law enforcement. You know, it started in the 1930s. Hoover got in touch with the ADL. They needed help because they had Nazi sympathizers who were trying to spread support for the Third Reich in America. And Hoover didn't have the people to go, if you will, place themselves inside these German-American social clubs and other environments. So he came to ADL and said, hey, can you help? So we've literally been working with the FBI since the 1930s. In the 50s, he worked with the FBI to help infiltrate the Klan and expose their membership roles and kind of put these racists, you know, to bed. And the goal for us, or the challenge for us, is how do we expand the number of trainings we do to support the demand that we're seeing from law enforcement?
How about dealing with bias within law enforcement itself? Because there are certainly occasions, we've seen plenty of them recently, in which some police officers, I'll get in trouble for even suggesting that, but we know that some police officers approach their job with a certain degree of bias day to day.
Yeah, well, I think there are issues of intrinsic bias in all kinds of environments, right? There's systematic racism in lots of places, or institutional racism. But, of course, in law enforcement's interaction with communities of color, those issues really are challenging and need to be addressed and understood and mitigated where possible. So we have new training we're developing, again, on how to handle intrinsic bias. At the end of the day, law enforcement is typically the front line in interacting with marginalized or underprivileged communities. And many of those law enforcement officers are sourced from those communities. Mm-hmm. So again, tackling these issues with honesty, being willing to put issues out on the table, I think is an important part of a 21st century policing program.
How involved does the ADL get with racial injustice? I know that the paramount is anti-Semitism, but you're much more than that, obviously.
Don, that's totally right. You know, what's interesting, when ADL was founded in 1913, the founders, they wrote a charter for this new organization. Mm-hmm. And we could, in it today, you could tease out what we would call a mission statement. And they wrote, quote, the purpose of ADL would be to stop the defamation of the Jewish people and secure justice and fair treatment to all. So it's interesting, in our founding document, if you will, there is this duality, this acknowledgement that we're going to fight anti-Semitism and hatred against Jews, but also work for the rights of all people, not just Jews. And that duality has powered the organization for over a century. It's why my predecessors marched with Dr. King. It's why the director of my St. Louis office was on the streets of Ferguson. So we see a connectivity between our fate and the fates of other peoples. And I'll be frank, in the environment today, brown-skinned people, broadly defined, whether you're a Latino or African-American, maybe a Muslim from overseas, or an Indian, South Asians, as we saw with the shooting that happened outside Kansas City back in February, they face a kind of prejudice and discrimination, which we as an organization committed to civil rights are compelled to try to deal with.
You do a lot of work in the interfaith community as well, which is, again, brings us back to where some of this problem is very pronounced.
That's right. I mean, just next week in New York, I'll be participating in an interfaith Seder for around the Passover holiday with Jewish school children, Catholic school children, and Muslim school children. Yeah. We do this sort of tripartite piece. The interfaith work is critical because if you look at anti-Semitism and often other forms of intolerance, religion-based intolerance is a big problem. For the Jewish people, we dealt with it coming from the church. Sometimes we deal with it coming from the mosques. But the response to that, I think, Don, can't be to run away from it. In fact, we've got to run right into it. And the vast majority of people, vast majority who are Muslim or Catholic or Protestant or Hindu or any denomination, there's no hate in their hearts. So I believe that we can use compassion to connect with the other and, again, build bridges.
Nothing works quite as well as having two people who may be different sit down and talk to each other and learn that they're really not very different after all.
That's right. When you can break through the filter bubbles of social media or the stereotypes we see in the press and you can break bread and you find out that we have much more in common than that which keeps us apart.
Well, I'm sure Karen Oresti, who's your representative here, has told you about the interfaith community here doing a lot of good work.
I can't help but sort of give it a plug and celebrate the fact that when the Jewish cemetery here was desecrated, I guess it was in February.
Yeah, that sounds right.
It was an interfaith cleanup effort organized by Governor Greitens, which really, in my mind, symbolized not just the problem, but the opportunity, bringing people together to clean up a cemetery may seem very sort of pedestrian, but I think it represents the highest ideals of our country.
And very interesting is the fact the Muslim community here raised more than $100,000 almost overnight.
Isn't that meaningful?
Very meaningful. Let's take a phone call. We have Sam calling from St. Louis County who'd like to talk to you, so let's bring him in. Go ahead, Sam. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
I have a statement and I guess a question. The statement is, I don't really see other groups that you talk about standing up for Jews. And it seems like the ADL spends a lot of time standing up for other people, even though it's a Jewish organization. So that's number one. Number two is, with all the intersectionality that's going on today, and I view this as a problem not of the right, but of the left, and BLM, BDS, all these people who are clearly anti-Zionist, if not anti-Semitic, depending on how you want to define that term. And how is the ADL, you know, expressing issues with these groups, the woman's group that was headed by Linda Sasour and people like that? I'd like to hear your comments.
Sure. So, Sam, those are great questions. So let me take both of them. So first of all, it is certainly true that ADL is a Jewish communal organization. That's how we started, as I said. But our mission compels us to fight not only for ourselves, but also for others. And I'll tell you that in some of the dark moments we've had in the past several months where our community was plagued by bomb threats, by vandalism, by other forms of harassment and hate crimes, some of the highest moments for me have been the outreach from people from other communities. And literally, I have heard from the CEOs of groups like the NAACP and the Urban League and the Human Rights Council, which fights for LGBT rights, who said to me, what can we do to help in this moment? I've heard from Muslim Americans, what can we do to help in this moment? And then I do think that the cemetery cleanup that Don mentioned earlier is notable, the online fundraising campaign. Now, that also, and so why was that important? The idea of American Muslims standing up and saying, we want to help clean up that cemetery, was very important in the public signal that it sent about how we can come together. Now, I think it's also worth noting that Linda Sarsour, one of the organizers of that, is actually a really hardcore anti-Zionist, and let me be clear about that. I believe that anti-Zionism is a contemporary form of anti-Semitism. Denying the rights of the Jewish people to self-determination is denying the basic rights that you would accord any other people. Let me tell you, that's anti-Semitism. Now, an individual, Linda or others, may have a problem with particular policies of the Israeli government. Hey, that's okay. But when you demonize and delegitimize and hold Israel to double standards, that is not okay, because all Jews end up getting swept up in that rhetoric. And so we have and will continue to speak out forcefully and firmly against those who would delegitimize the Jewish state and deny Jews the rights they would accord to all other people. So when Don, when the caller, Sam, talked about intersectionality, this is this theory that all struggles are related, that you have to be, if you're for women's rights, you have to be for Palestinian rights. And I would say, okay, that's fine. Because if you're for women's rights and Palestinian rights, you also should be for Jewish rights.
This right-wing nationalism that we've been talking about in this country is not peculiar just to this country. There's an awful lot of this going on in various parts of the world right now.
Most definitely. Populism is not an American phenomenon. And the extreme right has used populism as a vehicle to insert themselves into these mainstream conversations. We see it in Europe. You know, there's been a challenge with right-wing populism in Eastern Europe for many, many years. We have governments whose the political parties behind them have often very hostile to immigrants in particular, but often have histories of anti-Semitism. Mm-hmm. And on the left, look at the UK, where Jeremy Corbyn, who's the head of the Labour Party, espouses a kind of rhetoric that is nothing other than sort of a more sophisticated anti-Semitism. And you see it in France. France is facing elections in just 2 weeks where the National Front Party, that has historically been xenophobic and anti-Semitic, looks like they may be on the verge of victory. This is very problematic.
So what happens if, in fact, that does occur?
It's tricky. You know, Marie Le Pen, who's the very sophisticated head of the National Front, her father, Jean-Marie Le Pen, who founded the party, was not quite so sophisticated, if you will, and was much more open about his antipathies toward Jews and other minorities. Marie Le Pen's been much more careful about it. In fact, she has some Jewish supporters. But if you look at the agenda, it is one of intolerance. It is one of hate. It's one that we certainly can't countenance. And so our advice to our friends and in our Jewish friends and other non-Jewish friends in France is to be careful and to be wary and to get involved and engage, because you can't sit by and let these people take the ballot box.
Yeah. You mentioned internet earlier. Is there anything that can be done? And I know you've got a center on cyber hate technology.
Yep. That's right.
Is that something that can control some of the stuff that's out there on the internet? Because there's a lot of it.
You're right, Don. I mean, so the ADL is a ferocious advocate for the First Amendment, including freedom of expression and freedom of speech. But freedom of speech is not freedom to slander, right? And freedom of expression is not freedom to incite violence against Jews or other people. Now, the internet is, and social media in particular today, is where we shop, it's where we socialize, it's how we search, where many people get their news, find their friends, connect with loved ones. But the filter bubbles that kind of accrete around people, where you develop these echo chambers, become incredibly problematic. And again, the extreme right has exploited Twitter in particular in ways that are really troubling. So the ADL has been tackling this issue for some time. We run a working group on cyber hate. Google, Facebook, Twitter, Yahoo, Microsoft, Amazon, they all participate. We've helped them develop best practices around how to take down problematic anti-Semitic hateful speech. Again, not just against Jews, but other minorities too. And we just announced 2 weeks ago we're launching a center on technology and society in Silicon Valley, a presence in Palo Alto. It's really important, because if you want to fight intolerance today, you got to go online where we think much of this is concentrated.
We have to end our conversation here, but we'll put information about all of this on our website so that folks can learn more about it. And
I'm sure that's
exactly what you want. Jonathan Greenblatt is the CEO and National Director of the Anti-Defamation League. He will receive the Sister Mary Biles Peace and Justice Prize at a presentation and lecture at 7 o'clock this evening at Maryville University. Again, Jonathan, congratulations to you.
Thanks, Don. Thank you very much.
Archived versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.